I'd like to begin today asking a question. What sustains us in times of difficulty? You know, for some people, it can simply be willpower that they're just going to push through it. For some people, it's a vision of something better. If they have something to focus on, they can sustain or they can make it through a tough time. For some people, it's love of family or friends, knowing that they have support, that they have somebody that's going to be there for them. And for some people, it's just stubbornness. They're just going to muscle through it, and they'll be there no matter what. All those things can help sustain us, but I think there's something, especially for our Christian calling, that's more direct and important in this regard. And to that end, let me then ask this question. What if you were alone and singled out to receive some unfair punishment? How would you behave? It's oftentimes said that when you go through something like that, you really see who someone is, how they react to something that's unfair or untrue. We have examples of that in history. We have it in the church as well as the world. But just to kind of give you a mind vision, if you will, something to think about, you know, when the powerful want to take from the weak, who stands up to them? We see this in the world around us. We have great chaos in the world around us right now. Hong Kong is still not settled down, and they've got ongoing riots, and the Chinese government, I'm just surprised they haven't come in and locked everything down to this point, but it's basically the unfairness of life, what they were promised under British rule that was supposed to continue under Chinese rule, but it's not unique to Hong Kong. Peru still has ongoing riots, not as bad. They've simmered down some. Colombia as well. We have many other places in the world that are just very unsettled. But to go back to the point of how do you react when something is unfair, I have some questions. You know, why didn't the Jews in Germany stand together against Hitler's policies? It's a really sad chapter in their history because they all thought that they were the only true Jews, these various groups. And instead of bonding together and surviving this together, they turned on each other. And eventually there was no one else to turn in. To go to a painful part of our history here in this country, why didn't anyone publicly question Franklin Roosevelt's internment policies against the Japanese Americans? These were U.S. citizens, people they worked with, played with, lived next door to. They knew who these people were, and yet nobody said anything when they were shipped off. During his years as premier of Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev denounced many of the policies and atrocities of his predecessor, Joseph Stalin. And Joseph Stalin was just awful. And Nikita Khrushchev was one of a small handful of individuals in that inner circle after Stalin died. And eventually, Nikita Khrushchev was the guy. He was the premier of the Soviet Union. And he was, shortly after Stalin's death, censoring Stalin in a public meeting, talking about all the things that he had done wrong and whatnot. And from the audience, this heckler yelled out to Khrushchev, "You were one of Stalin's colleagues. Why didn't you stop him?" And Khrushchev roared back, "Who said that?" And the room went completely dead silent. Nobody wanted to say anything. Nobody wanted to move and draw attention. And after a few painful moments, Khrushchev replied quietly, "Now you know why." They were all intimidated, weren't they? Even under Khrushchev. Stalin killed somewhere around 20 million people. That number floats. If you go on Wikipedia, Google it or whatever, I've read numbers anywhere from 6 to 60 million people. He killed more of his own people during the war than the Nazis did. And then the number floats because what of the impact of indirect deaths from his policies? The famines, because of the policies, the five-year plans they rolled out that failed and all these sort of things. There are stories of individuals who stood alone in their convictions in the world around them. We usually call those people heroes, because they went against the conventional wisdom. When we read or hear of them, they inspire us. And with that sort of kicking around in my mind, I'm reminded of a billboard I saw years ago in New England, and this is part of what I want to build off my message today was from, is that this billboard struck my eye, because I saw it every day going back and forth to work, and it was a very simple billboard. The most effective ones usually are. This simply had a picture of a Bible, the front cover of a Bible, and next to it, it had the text that simply said, if all else fails, read the instructions. What struck me was how unique that would be to people, because what this billboard was trying to do was get people to go to church. It was a religious coalition in Rhode Island, and they were trying to get people to think back to attending church. But you and I almost take that for granted, don't we? We think about the literal meaning of that sentence, that the Bible really is an instruction manual, isn't it? It tells us how to live life, what God's plan and purpose is, why we attend even on a Sabbath, what the point of religion is, if we want to use that term. We come here every week to gather as a group to be taught and instructed from that book. As an organization, as a church, as individuals, at the core of our religious convictions, we believe in taking the Bible as it is written, don't we? We follow that. We don't follow traditions. We believe that God's will is clear to us through the pages of His Word, the Bible, that we can find principles to live by. Even if specifics that fit our situation aren't there, we still have guidelines. In today's society, by way of contrast, being religious in any sense of the being or the meaning of the word is increasingly difficult, isn't it? To have a public discourse about God or religion in general is forbidden. Setting aside a whole day, especially a Saturday, to attend church is seen as foolishness. What do people think when a person says that they base their way of life on the Word of God? It almost becomes suspect, like they're not strong enough to think on their own. Many of you know what I'm talking about because you've heard firsthand when you're questioned, why do you keep the Sabbath? Why do you keep these holy days? Why don't you do Christmas or whatever it happens to be? And we answer those questions, and they don't really know what to do with that, do they? This time of year with Christmas is another example. People around us are so caught up in this time. Whether they're religious or not, and increasingly it is not a religious holiday. But more and more, they're caught up in it as something that they fit into their life rather than God's way fitting into their life. Their life fitting into His, I should say. And I'm reminded of an acquaintance I had back in Ohio many years ago who was a minister for a Baptist congregation, and he made the observation to me one time we were chatting that his church was standing room only on the two big holidays of the year, Christmas and Easter. The rest of the year, he couldn't beg those people to show up for worship. And one year, he'd had enough of it, and I guess he figured he didn't have anything to lose. And so as he welcomed everybody to his Christmas service, he wished them a happy Easter as well. Because he knew he wouldn't see them again until Easter. So he'd get them both. Most people view God's Word very casually, don't they? We give it marginal effort. And I want to talk about that today. We must have a personal conviction and commitment to the calling that God has given us, increasingly as the times around us heat up. This past week, after the elections in England, the Conservatives swept into power. It stunned everybody. And Mr. Johnson could not get any kind of plan for Brexit, it's called, for England leaving the EU. Well, now that there's a Conservative majority in the Parliament, they did. They signed an exit strategy. Now we'll see what the EU does with it. Germany's economy is faltering. For a long time, it chugged along and didn't seem to have anything stopping it, but that puts in question certain things. President Trump has hammered from the beginning of his presidency that the NATO needs to do more to pull their own weight, and they're considering it, but the downside to that is if they start pulling more of their own weight, why do they need to listen to us? So there are a lot of things out there in the world. Conviction and commitment are going to be much needed in the calling we have ahead of us especially, and so I want to look at that today. Let's begin in Judges 21. By way of setting the stage here, the book of Judges is a very interesting read. If you want something to do to read in the next couple of weeks or month or so, I would encourage you to read the book of Judges and ponder how much of what they went through during that time period is similar to what we're dealing with now. Judges 21:25 summarizes it for us. Simply says, in those days, this is the period of the judges, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We're there as a culture, aren't we? That's going to create challenges for this country moving forward, because one of the things that helped make this nation great was that we were unified. It might not have been unified around the right things, but we were unified as a culture, as a people, as a vision of what we wanted to accomplish. We were unified. We couldn't do anything like win the Second World War with where we are today. We're too conflicted internally. Put a man on the moon? We can't agree on basics, let alone visions of that nature. But morally, look where we are as well. What is off limits now? Almost nothing. There's very few things left that are forbidden or taboo in the culture around us. And so with that in mind, let's look at the rest of the story, if you will, beginning in Ruth chapter 1. Within the context of the period of the judges and everyone doing what was right in his own eyes, God became marginalized, very much like the culture around us in this country today. And so then we pick up a story of a certain family. And it wasn't just a certain family, as we'll see here in a moment, but Ruth 1, verse 1, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, it's the end of the previous book, that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. When the Bible uses the expression, a certain man, it is not someone of anonymity. It is usually someone you need to pay attention to. We'll see why concerning this here in a moment. To continue in verse 2, the name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. The names of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. If you do read Judges and you want to pick up the rest of this story, look up the names, the meanings of the names Mahlon and Chilion. They're not happy names. So already it seems like Elimelech and Naomi had a sense of things not going very well in their lives. It says they were Ephraimites of Bethlehem, Judah. They went to the country of Moab and they remained there. So they didn't just go there for a short time because they needed to, they had to, and then they were going to go back. They went and stayed. Verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. She was left and her two sons. And this begins to set a stage for her being in a very tough spot because there was no safety net. There was no kingdom. There was no temple. God was marginalized, and so a widow was basically at the mercy of her family. And we'll see here that begins to crumble very quickly. She has her two sons, verse 4. They took wives of the women of Moab. They weren't intending to go home. This was now their new home. The name of one was Orpah, the name of the other was Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. So you can see that this was a permanent thing in their mind. They weren't looking at going back home. In verse 5, then her world comes crashing down around her ears. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So 10 years after Elimelech, now all of the men are dead. The woman survived her two sons and her husband. And it's a very sad story to start out with, isn't it? What does she have left? Life is tough in the land of Judah. They picked up and moved to Moab to try to make that life better. Then her husband dies. 10 years later, her sons die. And now it's not just her, it's their wives that are also on the margins. Who do they have left to take care of them? But why is this story important to us? Well, to jump ahead a little bit, if you've read the book before, you know that Ruth becomes the great-grandmother of David. We'll come back to that later. To get the full picture, though, we need to look at the family history. To go back to Abraham, and when God made his covenant with Abraham, he told him that he was going to make him a father of a great multitude. Told him to look up into the stars if he could count them. That's how many descendants he would have. So Abraham, of course, had Isaac, the son of promise, the heir. Isaac had Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, as we rehearsed last week. Israel, of course, had 12 sons. One of those was Judah. Judah then had a son named Phares. Some areas in Scripture call him Perez. Phares had a son named Ezrom. Again, in some places he's named Hezron. Hezron or Esrom had Aram, also called Ram. Aram had Amminadab, who had Nason, who's also called Nashon. Nashon had Salmon. Who was Salmon? Salmon married Rahab. And Salmon and Rahab had a son they named Elimelech. Elimelech was not just any man. He was a certain man. A certain man meant that he was to be the leader of the tribe. It was not his place to leave when things got tough. It was his place to stay and lead, not abandon the tribe. His commitment wavered when things got hard. Ruth is important to us because she steps into the picture and shows us her conviction. And what's especially damning, if you will, is that she's not even an Israelite, is she? She saw God clearer than most of the nation did. She was willing to sacrifice everything to give her commitment and her conviction to God completely. Let's look at that a little bit. Verse 8. After all the men are dead, Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law, "Go return each to your mother's home. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. I wish you well. I can't take care of you. Go back to your families," because that's all they had. Verse 9, "The Eternal grant you that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." And if you read the book of Ruth, Naomi says that to Ruth at one point. "I want you to find rest, security, safety, all that came in a godly marriage." So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. This was very emotional. 10 years they had been together. All that they had seen and been a part of, and their husbands dying. This is not something you rip apart easily. And so verse 10, they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." That's what they intended. But the reality again is, what does she have to offer them? So then to pick it up in verse 14, moving down a little bit, they lifted up their voices, they wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Orpah kissed her because she was leaving. She was going to go back to her family. But Ruth didn't want to. She wanted to stay with Ruth. And so Naomi says, verse 15, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you." Notice her conviction and commitment here. In spite of what she had grown up with, in spite of the culture, the nation she was in spite of having every opportunity to forsake what she had seen and glimpsed in Elimelech's family and leave that, she chose the opposite. She says, "Forever, wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Eternal do so to me, and more also, if anything but death departs you and me." And when she saw Naomi, that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her about this matter. She realized the conversation's done. Ruth made her choice. We won't read it, but chapter 2 then sees Naomi and Ruth returning to the tribe of Judah. And Naomi had no idea what she was going to receive as a welcoming, or a welcoming at all. But she was going back to a land, to a people, to a place where she had no support, no other family to take care of her, but willing to suffer the hardship to return to God's chosen nation. So chapter 3 in verse 1, Naomi, being a good mother-in-law, says to Ruth, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you?" Now what security is Ruth going to have? Security of a family. And so she plants this thought in Ruth's mind, doesn't she? That she needs to pay attention to Boaz, that he's a near kinsman, that he has the ability to take care of her and provide for her and be a good husband that she needs. And we know the rest of the story. And Naomi approaches Boaz, but Boaz says that he's not the nearest kinsman. The way I read the book of Ruth, Elimelech was the oldest brother. The unnamed brother was the middle. Boaz was the youngest. Boaz didn't have the right of redemption in the Levirate marriage to raise up an heir to Ruth's dead husband. But he could if the next brother refused. And so in chapter 4 and verse 6, we see that. The close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself. He had to buy, he had to pay, if you will, to cover the debts, to buy it back if they had leased it out or given it out before the Jubilee year, would return it to the family. And he says, I can't. It's going to cost me too much. He didn't see a return on it. He was looking at it the wrong way, wasn't he? And so then in verse 9, Boaz approaches the elders and he decides that he's going to step up. He had no reason to do this. He's a much older man than Ruth. You go back and read the account, he even says that to her. Why are you coming to me? There are much younger men out there that can take care of you. But he decided he would follow through on his responsibility. Boaz then says to the elders and all the people, a very public thing, he was going to fulfill the covenant, if you will. He says, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's, all Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off. See, in a levirate marriage, the first child from this relationship would technically not be his. It would be Mahlon's heir. That's why the other brother didn't want to do this, because then it would all transfer through that child. But Boaz here is saying publicly, I've done all that. I've taken care of it so that his name may not be cut off from his brethren, from his position at the gate. See, he was to be a leader. Elimelech was. And then his son, the oldest son, was supposed to, and they left all that. Their conviction, their commitment failed. So he says, you're witnesses to this day. And so then to move down to verse 13, Boaz took Ruth, she became his wife, and when he went into her, the Eternal gave her conception, she bore a son, which is very interesting. How many years was she married to her husband previously? No child. You think maybe God wasn't blessing that union because he wasn't doing the right thing? I can only suppose, but it makes me wonder. And so verse 14, the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Eternal who has not left you this day without a close relative. Naomi had no idea this was the way everything was going to play out when she went back, did she? No idea what was going to happen to Ruth. No idea that Boaz would be the one to step up and fulfill the responsibility. She was very sad when she went back, which is very understandable, isn't it? She had lost everything that she knew, had no idea what was going to take place in the future. And here the women are acknowledging this. Blessed be the Eternal who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. And isn't that ironic? You can't get much more famous than being part of the legacy of who became the Messiah. May he be a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better than seven sons, has borne him. Ruth stepped up in a way that her sons never did. This is part of what they're acknowledging here. Ruth's conviction and commitment to God's way of life brought tremendous blessings, didn't it? Brought her strength and courage to move forward in a time when she had no idea what was going on. For her to be singled out, do you know how hard it was for her as a Moabitess to leave her country, come back to Judah, Bethlehem, Judah, where she had never lived? And they knew she was a Moabitess, a foreigner, in their eyes, a pagan. And then to try to be part of that society. But she brought honor back to Naomi and the family line, didn't she? Simply through her actions, her conviction, and her commitment. Again, Israel during this time would be very familiar to us. If we were transported back, we would see conditions that are very similar to what we witness around us. Society had drifted far from God. Religion was less and less convenient in people's lives. They couldn't be bothered with God. Ruth's story is very powerful for many reasons, the least of which is that she wasn't marginal, was she? She didn't play at this. She didn't go back and sort of do this and then not do it for a while and then do that. And she put her whole heart into it, didn't she? She was going to be in the family of God. She decided she wanted to be in that nation, to be an Israelite, to live as God wanted her to live. And even though she was not part of the bloodline of Israel on any level, she became part of Israel and an heir to the Messiah. I'm sorry, ancestor to the Messiah. But think how marginal people are around us, in the world around us. Even when it comes to something like Christmas, we're in this season now. And it's amazing how many people, to them, this is just another event. It's not a religious holiday. They shop because it's expected. But they wouldn't darken the door of a church the rest of the year. That's what my minister friend back in Ohio realized. But they would ease their conscience, showing up to church, you know, Christmas Eve, if he had a service then, or Christmas Day. But how would God bless us? Why would God bless us if we only showed up for one or two of his holy days? He wouldn't know where we stood on anything, would he? It's easy to show up when it's convenient. It takes commitment to show up when it's not. You look at the traditions associated with Christmas, and in many ways, they're empty gestures. You know, if you don't send me a card, I'm not going to send you one next year. So we look at all this, and I find, again, parallels in the culture around us. The world looks at God's commands, and they say, essentially, how close can I get to sinning or being wrong, and God will still look at me and bless me, as opposed to saying, how far away can I get from that sin? God seeks more from us. He's not interested in the marginal. He wants a total commitment. That was the condemnation to the church of Laodicea, wasn't it? Revelation 3. I want you to be hot or cold. I'd rather you be hot, but at least if you're cold, I know where you stand. If you're lukewarm, you're in the middle. I have no idea where you are. And I think that's why this story of Ruth fits in so well here. Again, Ruth walked away from everything she knew in the society that she grew up in. And she realized that God had something better to offer, and she wanted every bit of it. Wasn't much different than Rahab in that regard, was she? And so what was the result? Well, certainly blessings in her life. She had a child, she had a husband to take care of her, a life beyond what she could have imagined in Moab. She became the great-grandmother of probably the greatest king of Israel and later part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. God doesn't just give that opportunity to anyone, but he's going to give it to those that are committed. I have to wonder what he has in store for all of us. If you notice the end of chapter 4 here in verse 18, this is the genealogy. I mentioned some of that earlier, and it starts out with Perez. Again, Perez was the son of Judah. So it picks up from there, and it says, now this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nashon. Nashon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. This is the genealogy. Do you know who's not in that list? Elimelech. He lost his opportunity. Being marginal took him out of the picture. His name's not even mentioned here. It's as if he never existed. He forfeited his birthright as a leader of the nation, the tribe of Judah. And so God replaced him. Ruth's story is just one story, but we have so many more to look at. Let's look at Hebrews 11 next. We're not going to go through everything, probably just kind of summarize as we look at this chapter. Hebrews 11 is known as the faith chapter. Many individuals, not all, but many as examples to us of individuals who had extreme commitment and conviction to follow God in his way of life. And in almost every instance that's highlighted for us, it was never convenient. You know, we can sort of sanitize some of these events looking back in history because we don't have all the details. But it begins talking about Abel. You would think, well, Abel didn't have a bad life until Cain killed him, but that's the culmination of a lot of anger. It's not the start of it. What kind of relationship did they have to begin with? And yet, no matter how angry Cain was, Abel was going to do the right thing, brought the right offering, tried to live the right way. Cost him his life, didn't it? Enoch, verse 5, talks about him being taken away so he could not see death. And then it quotes, and he was not found because God took him. And many have misunderstood that, thinking God took him to heaven. No, God allowed him to rest in the grave because they wanted to kill him. He was one of the lone voices, if not the lone voice, in a time period of mankind's history that God says their only thought was evil. Well, as I said, if you and I were to go on Channel 4 or one of the local channels here and we started preaching this, how much hate mail do you think we would get? A lot. So think about Enoch and how much hate he got. They wanted to kill him. They hated him so much. That's not a convenient life. Noah preached for 120 years while that ark was being prepared. Not one person listened to what he was warning them. They believed him once the ark was closed and the water started rising, didn't they? But before that, but what kind of commitment does it take to remain faithful to a message that nobody is listening to for 120 years? It takes a lot, doesn't it? Because it gets tiring. If you've been given a task and nobody appreciates it, how much do you want to put your heart into that task? It's really hard, isn't it? If not impossible. Abraham, it says, when he obeyed by faith, he was called to go out to a place he would receive as an inheritance, but he didn't know where he was going. He grew up in Ur. He stood out like a sore thumb, especially when he moved down towards Canaan. Who is this guy? He was nobody in that area. He didn't own any land, any rights in the area. They hated his shepherds. But verse 10, he waited for the city which has a foundation whose builder and maker is God. One of the early interesting and sort of curious things about God's people is that every generation has believed they're the last, don't they? Surely it can't go on much longer. But even Abraham realized and knew that there was a time coming when God was going to bring his kingdom back to this earth. That takes a lot of conviction. He lived to be an old man. He waited over 25 years for the promised heir. All that happened in those city-states and those other kings that tried to take property and take lives from all the other people in the area, and Abraham standing there trying to live God's way of life. Sarah was right there with him, wasn't she? We talk about Abraham a lot, but what about Sarah's faith? You who are mothers, and maybe even some of you that are mothers that have struggled to have children, you understand what Sarah went through. But it says they died in faith, verse 13, not having received the promises, but seeing them afar off. Without conviction, without commitment, you're not going to see that. You're not going to have the faith to withstand it. And so then verse 23, Moses was born and was shortly after that in the lap of luxury, wasn't he? Grew up in the house of the Pharaoh's daughter. Anything he wanted was his for the asking. And then God switches things up where he's no longer welcomed in the royal court. He flees for his life. He spends 40 years herding sheep, which was probably excellent training for the next 40 years of herding other sheep. But of those 40 years, how much did they respect and obey and listen to Moses? He even lost his anger several times at them. One time cost him being able to go into the promised land, didn't it? But how do you lead people 40 years through a desert environment? Don't think desert like Sahara. Think desert like Northern California. High desert. It's still rough living. And so then we come down to verse 32. What more shall I say? There are so many more examples, Paul says here. So many more faithful that we could talk about. He says, the time would fail me to tell of Gideon. Look at Gideon. Gideon was a nobody. Threshing grain in an old wine press, and he hides, which is understandable. I'm not chiding him for that. I'd probably do the same thing. Because every time the Israelites would get their harvest, they would get it separated out, then the other nations would sweep in and take all their work from them. But God did a powerful thing through him, didn't he? 300 men they whittled down to. Trumpets, torches with pitchers. They wanted to make him a king after that. But it didn't go so well after his death. But still the commitment that he had, unwavering. Samson, look at Samson. You might not think of him as being a man of conviction and commitment, but he was just a slow learner. But he got there, didn't he? Didn't listen to mom and dad when he was young. Went and did what he thought he needed to do. That all didn't go very well. He ended up with his eyes gouged out, burned out, turning a turnstile like a beast of burden. He had a lot of time to think. But it says when he brought down that temple and he killed more Philistines than he did in that one moment than all the rest of his life. He was willing to die for that. Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets, verse 33, who through faith subdued kingdoms. We don't think about that in the literal sense, but it did happen at times. Worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. Can you imagine Daniel and the abuse he took? Daniel's not listed directly in here. But you think the politics of your company is bad? Try being at the top of not one, but two world-ruling empires. There was probably dozens of people that wanted his skin. And to be thrown into that lion den, he had no idea what was going to happen any more than his three friends did when they were thrown in the furnace. But he didn't waver, did he? Verse 34, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. And this is what we want, isn't it? When we obey God, we want to see these amazing things happen, and sometimes they do. Answered prayers and blessings that come out of nowhere that just stun us in what God has provided. But it doesn't always work that way. Notice the middle of verse 35, others were tortured. Are we committed to our calling to the point that we could be tortured and it wouldn't change anything? People will say and do anything to stop pain. Not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And therein is a huge key. Conviction and commitment comes from a vision of something more important than what we have now. And that's true of any of these examples we've talked about. Ruth had a vision. Maybe she didn't fully understand what that vision was going to be, but she knew that that God in Judah, Bethlehem, Judah, in Israel, that God was going to provide something better than she could ever imagine, and he did. Many of us came into this church because God opened our minds to something that was truly astounding, that we could be in his family. And I don't know that we still really even understand that, to have his mind, his character, his nature. I mean, what is off limits at that level, in terms of creating, of terms of knowledge, we can't even really comprehend that. And yet we have that vision, don't we? Does that sustain us? Does that strengthen us? Verse 36, still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment. You know, Joseph, when he was in jail, they were stoned. I mean, look at Stephen. He wasn't going to hold anything back. They were wrong. And he knew what God was offering, what God taught, what God expected. But again, it cost him his life, didn't it? I have four brothers. I know what it's like to be hit by rocks. But that's nothing like being stoned. These are rocks big enough that you have to heave. Two hands, not something you can put in one hand and throw. They were sawn in two. This seems to be an illusion. Tradition says that Isaiah was put in a hollow log by Manasseh and sawed in half while he was alive. You have to have conviction when that's happening, and you know that this is the end of your physical life. They were tempted. They were slain by the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented. And this is what we signed up for. But it's not just that, is it? Because notice verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy. Why is the world not worthy of these people? Because the conviction and the commitment is to and through God for something so much better than anything this world has to offer. And we can be so distracted at times from car repairs and jobs and family issues and the politics of the world around us that we can lose sight of this at times. And this is the caution I'm hoping that I can show you today. Are we worthy to be accounted sons and daughters of the Most High God? Will we stay the course? I've seen too many people walk away over the years. When things got hard, they finally said, I'm done. So it says they wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves, and all of these having obtained a good testimony through faith. The testimony was to God. The testimony was those that watched what God was doing in them, through them, like Ruth, like Abraham, like Sarah, like Moses, like all those faithful, like so many of you are doing. The character of a man is not revealed when things are good. The character of a man is revealed when things are hard. And so verse 40, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. We're going to be there together. That's an amazing thing to consider, isn't it? Do we have the commitment to be there? Without conviction and without commitment, God could not have accomplished what he did in these faithful. And all the other examples that we could point to in Scripture, and we can even point to in our lives, of individuals who have inspired us. But he wants us to have what they had as well. The relationship with him, the clear understanding of what he is doing and what he is offering, and what we can have in his family. And God is so then seeking out a people that are not consumed with the convenient. It's not convenient when we have chronic health issues. It's not convenient when we cycle through jobs like last week's laundry. It's not convenient when we're singled out at work or at school or in our neighborhoods because we don't put up the lights or we don't have the tree out or we're not doing the parties or we're not doing whatever. It's not convenient, is it? This is not about convenience. This is about wanting to be in God's family. God needs to see what we're going to do over a lifetime. For some, that may be 10 years. For some, that may be 80 years. But he needs to know what's at our heart, what we will do when things get hard. God seeks a people that will take that conviction and turn it into deep commitment. Nothing is going to shake it because it is firmly established upon him. And so then we'll put that action or belief or conviction into obeying and following God. And it will truly astound everybody around us. It will make no sense to them, but God will know. So as we look at the coming winter, the lack of sunshine, and the cold weather that's bound to come at some point, let's commit ourselves to focusing on God's plan of salvation. Passover will be here in a blink. Let's commit ourselves to God's word, making it come alive in our thoughts and actions. Let's make it so internalized that there is no questioning what kind of conviction or commitment we have. And remember, above all things, before anything else fails, to read the instruction book.